One of the things that people inevitably share about or identify as being important in a church is a sense of community, experience of community, of being accepted and valued, of having a safe place to be yourself, hopefully to grow in faith with others. We believe that life is expanded to God's intended fullness when we are unified, when we are many in Christ. An important way of building genuine community is to hear each other's stories, what is traditionally called testimony, which is simply to say, this is what I've seen, this is what I've experienced, this is what I've heard. And from time to time, we invite various members of our fellowship to share something from their journey, of experiences that have strengthened them, of changes and challenges that have been significant shapers in their lives. So I'm glad we'll be hearing from a few voices this morning, Kayla Drudge and Laura Thiessen and Russ and Christina Dick. Yes, Russ and Christina are quite a ways from here in Georgia, serving as Jubilee Partners, but they responded positively to our invitation to write a little testimony of their recent life. And Don is going to be the voice of Russ and Christina this morning. So Kayla, I invite you to begin. Just for the record, I didn't twist Kayla's arm to do this. That was Kelvin's pleasure, but I support it fully.
Good morning, Covenant people. It's lovely to see you all. For those of you who might not know who I am, my name is Kayla Drudge, and I'm known around here as the daughter of Kevin and Rochelle Drudge. So Kelvin has asked me to spend a couple of minutes telling you about my experience at university in the past couple of years. I've spent the past 2 years studying at Canadian Mennonite University in Winnipeg. I've mostly been studying music with some courses in philosophy and theology on the side. So, as is common for many university students, I am sure, in the past few years, I've spent a lot of time trying to come up with insightful reflections on topics or experiences that I probably wouldn't ever have thought about if they hadn't been assigned to me. This past semester, I completed a practicum course for which all my assignments were extensive written reflections on various aspects of my experience. So when Kelvin asked me to reflect on my university experience here today, my immediate thought was, yes, that is something I know how to do now. This is kind of fun for me because in school, I'm given like a pretty narrow range of topic on which to reflect. But Kelvin just said, reflect. And so I got to choose what to talk about today. Oddly enough, when I think about my experience in school in the past few years and all the things I've learned and come to love or disagree with, the thing that I really wanted to reflect on today is the process of reflecting itself. By the end of my practicum course this past April, I felt like I had reflected the heck out of my life. Like I'd sucked it dry of any hint of insight it may once have had to begin with. And so I felt so ready to just live my life and stop trying to pull deep meaning out of it. But as I found so far in life, often when I try to stop looking for deep meaning, it pops up on me right where I was trying not to look. Looking back on my admittedly very brief period of university schooling thus far, I think that the course I feel most conflicted about is the required Bible course that I took in my first semester called Biblical Literature and Themes. This course was basically a survey of the Bible front to back, and it was a severely detailed course. Genesis to Revelation, we had to memorize the who's and the what's and the why's and the how do we interprets, and we also had to write an absurd amount of detailed reflection on our readings of biblical passages and exegetical texts. Now, I was raised in the church, and as those of you who know my family might imagine, there's often quite a bit of dense theological conversation that takes place at my family gatherings on my mom's side of the family. And I've never felt like I paid too much attention to these conversations, but either I've paid more attention than I thought, or it just seeped into my brain somehow. Because in this course, I found that I seemed to know exactly the language and the perspective and the nuances that my theology professor was looking for in the reflections that she assigned to us. So I wrote these reflections, and I tried my best to make them sound like something my dad would say in a sermon, or my grandpa would say in a lecture, and my prof returned them with top marks and comments like, "Thank you for your honest, thoughtful reflections." And that is what made this course difficult for me in a way that has honestly stuck with me ever since. My professor was pleased with my reflections because they were well written, hopefully, but they weren't true. I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that every time I wrote about how I felt about a certain Bible passage or theological idea, I was just making it up. Over and over, I wrote things like, "This passage struck a deep chord within me," when in reality, that passage only stuck out to me because I made an educated guess that that was the passage that was supposed to stick out to me. And every time I think about that course now, I wish I'd written those reflections honestly. The thing is, I didn't fake my way through that course because I don't have any thoughts about the Bible or spirituality, so I had to make some up. I have a head full of thoughts about this stuff, but I couldn't fit my thoughts and questions into the language and theological framework that I presumed my professor wanted to hear. I couldn't articulate my honest reflections into papers that I was convinced would get me the grades I wanted, so instead of working through this stuff and exploring what I believed and thought about the Bible, I just mimicked the words and ideas I'd learned from being a pastor's kid. The reason I wanted to talk about this today is that I think this course set the tone for my schooling in a way. I can probably count on one hand the amount of assignments that I've written in the past 2 years that have been genuine. Mostly everything I've written has been carefully crafted to get me high marks in the good opinion of my professor. I've learned how to write a nice reflective sounding paper, but I haven't learned how to genuinely reflect, how to figure out what I want to say. In the past couple months, I've started noticing this habit come up in a way that really bothers me. I found myself in some deep, meaningful conversations with people who I really respect on topics that I care about a lot. And I find myself having a really hard time being genuine and honest in these conversations. We'll be talking about some spirituality or religion, and they'll ask me what I think about something. And instead of saying what I think, I find myself trying to figure out what they want to hear. Although I've learned a lot in university about Christianity and philosophy, and I've come across so many new ideas and ways of thinking, I mostly haven't engaged with it through the lens of how it resonates with me. And this, to me, is totally tragic because the other thing I've learned in these past few years and that I think is that I think that one of the most incredible things, maybe the most incredible thing we can do as humans is to form genuine, soul-deep connections with other people. And one of the biggest ways we can do that is to have the conversations that I mentioned in which we are honest in exploring the questions of who we are and why we might be here and what it means to love in this crazy world. To do that, you need the ability to reflect on your experiences, and you need the capability of doing so deeply and honestly from your soul. University has taught me well how to articulate myself in a reflective way, but how to reflect honestly and genuinely in a way that invites the kind of connections that make our souls feel unlonely, that is something I'm trying to figure out now that school is out. And thank you for letting me do that with you here today.
That's for you to look at and salivate over. We're going to cut it open during the potluck later, but this is what my life is all about right now. I'm sort of consumed with making bread. As I followed a whim of my own to learn how to make sourdough bread, I began learning about bread in general, the ingredients in bread, the types of grains used to make bread, and the types of risers. Why is she talking about bread? Wasn't she supposed to talk about how God has been working in her life this last year? What does bread have to do with it? Everything! Bread is everything! This is my body broken for you. Eat this bread and remember me. Magical yeast growing on the husk of the grain, feeding on the crushed grain and growing at such a rate that it pushes out the bad bacteria, pre-digesting the wheat to make the nutrients more accessible to your body. Bread to feed your body and your soul. The critical importance of bread is recognized the world over. When orphans were rescued from Holocaust camps, it was discovered that even in their new safe homes with full bellies, they could not fall asleep at night. someone decided to put the children to bed with a bit of bread. And miraculously, all of them began sleeping through the night. When they had the assurance of their next meal in their hand, they felt comforted and could sleep. Bread is eaten all around the world in all kinds of forms, and it is made at home by the mama. That's me. I find making bread very centering. Knowing that every generation that has gone before has participated in this tradition makes me feel connected to an important story. Measuring out the ingredients is tidy and orderly, unlike much of my life. Kneading the dough is a physical, sensory experience. Smelling the dough rising, waiting and waiting and watching it rise. Sourdough rises so slowly sometimes. This loaf rose for 24 hours before it was ready to bake. It doesn't always rise at exactly the same rate. Every element of the preparation of the dough can change the speed at which it rises. The room temperature, the amount of flour you used, the type of flour you used, how long you kneaded it, how wet the dough was. It's not like commercial yeast that rises exactly as specified on the label. Failure is a distinct possibility. It is a challenge to understand all the elements. They're okay, just let them play. Unless they go to the kitchen and start eating food. Because that's what Benji's been doing lately, sneaking in and eating all the food that's on the counter. Do you ever go to the fruit bowl and see that every single piece of fruit has one bite out of it? Is that just me? That happens. So sourdough bread's a challenge to understand all the elements and how each one works together to produce the loaf of your dreams, or sometimes the loaf you never expected, but which you find is still edible. Unfortunately, sourdough's so complicated that many people never even try it. I find the complexity the very basis of its attractiveness. It's a lot like mothering. My experience of mothering is that it requires learning how to love like Jesus in every different circumstance and with every different child. A new lesson and the same old lesson every moment of every day. So intense, so humbling. When you're kneading sourdough, the directions in my recipe say the dough should be sticky, but more interested in sticking together than in sticking to your hands. I love that description. Dough on your hands doesn't get in the loaf. It gets washed down the drain or wiped into the garbage. Sticking together is what makes the dough bake up properly. It's how you avoid waste and the only way you get enough edible bread to share with others. Lately, I've been learning a lot about eating well. This adventure in sourdough leaches into food of every kind, right? Two very important elements in my life collided: parenting and food. Mealtimes are often stressful. Someone is shouting, another person singing, food is scattered all over, dishes are piled high, and I'm feeling like I have to do it all by myself in the midst of this noisy circus parade, tromping underfoot, yelling that they're hungry, and stealing cheese when your back is turned. The next sentence I wrote a bad word. Should I just read it? The shit hit the fan when Seamus decided he didn't like anything I served, no matter what. I'm not exaggerating. You can ask Derek. For more than 2 weeks straight, and still, three times a day, we hear, I hate what you made! This food smells disgusting! I'm not eating it! That's not fun. For anybody, really. So I started researching how to get your child to eat vegetables, raising adventurous eaters. Maybe you have some idea, but I had no idea until I began this education how many books and articles are out there on how to get your child to eat vegetables. It's ridiculous. That was my conclusion. This is ridiculous. It has to be easier than this. Surely there's a more natural way to get children to eat what you put in front of them. I expect children not to listen to logic when they see something green, but surely I don't have to hide vegetables in food or trick my children into eating well. Finally, I was forced to consider this. Perhaps if all you offer them is food that is good for them, when they are hungry, they must eat it. Perhaps my problem wasn't the children's attitude toward food, because they're just following their palate, which I helped develop after all. Perhaps my problem was the food I put in front of them. Back to sourdough bread. I feel good about feeding my family sourdough bread. It has only three ingredients: flour, water, and salt. It is fermented, it has no preservatives and no weird ingredients I can't pronounce. It's a wholesome traditional food that my great-grandmother could have taught me to make if given the chance. Sourdough starter is a careful collection and nurturing of the good yeasts and bacteria used to rise bread. I don't know how many of you have done sourdough. Raise your hand if you have ever done sourdough, like from made your own starter, yeah? Or got a starter from someone else. I've heard it talked about like mowing a weed-filled lawn. The more you mow it, the fewer weeds can grow, and eventually the grass can hold its own. So with sourdough, you throw a little of the starter away each time you feed it, giving it more good yeast from the husks of new grain and taking away a little of the questionable growth each time. While you're establishing your starter, you have to feed it twice a day. It's like adding a child to your household, only quieter. A little over a year ago, we found out that we had an unplanned bun in the oven. Now that was scary. Four was frightening. Jim Gaffigan says, people ask what having four children is like, and I tell them it's like this. Imagine you're drowning, and then someone hands you a baby. I was scared. I prayed for confidence, for gentleness, compassion. That is when I wasn't praying for the puking to stop. I wanted to feel happy, but I could barely function. My children were surviving with the ghost of a mother, and Derek was picking up a boatload of slack. The problem with sourdough starter is that eventually, if you don't feed it, it consumes all the energy in the flour, and then it dies. We were given this lovely starter, but we hadn't milled any grain to feed it on, and it was hungry. It's not a good feeling to be surrounded by needs and not be able to meet them. Several years back, I put in dreadlocks to outwardly go into mourning when a good friend of mine and my Grammy died within 2 weeks of each other. In November last year, I decided I needed to put off the mourning hair and put on lovely hair to anticipate with joy the birth of this new baby. The day I started brushing out my dreadlocks, my mom fell and suffered a brain injury. I kept one dreadlock to remind me that suffering and pain are part of life, and grief needs to be acknowledged, and more than acknowledged, allowed and supported. The beautiful thing is that Penelope's birth and postpartum has been so much more positive than Benjamin's, and I've not experienced serious depression this time around. The prayer for joy that was cutting off my dreadlocks was answered. As I was in the midst of looking forward and growing forward into this little baby, I was holding my own mother's hand, metaphorically, of course, from 2,000 miles away. While I was pregnant, Mom got worse than we ever expected before she began healing. While she was in the hospital, I compared my mom's progress with my baby's. Mom was on a ventilator. My baby was not yet breathing on its own. And my mom rarely got to see the light of day, and my baby hadn't yet seen the sun. I wondered if, while we were all thinking this was the worst thing that could ever happen to her, Mom was really the lucky one to get to experience a kind of rebirth at a time in her life where she could actually understand and reflect on it. My sisters, neither of whom have children, got to experience being needed the way a parent is needed by a child. It is what God intended for us, that we would be loved and raised up by our parents to go and love others. I think it was so special that my mom was carried and loved and supported through a period of total dependence on others by two young women who she carried and loved and supported. A perfect circle. We are each necessary to one another's growth. The longer sourdough rises, the more fermenting it does, which makes it more tangy. But you have to bake it. You put this lovely risen dough into an environment that kills all the bacteria and yeast that you've spent days and weeks cultivating. This is ridiculous, right? This is crazy. But it's also necessary to make the dough into the most nutritious food it can be. The heat penetrates the holes in the risen dough and bakes the bread from the inside out. Did you know that? That's why bread has to rise, so that there are holes in it, and the heat of the oven heats up the air inside the holes first. It doesn't heat into the dough. It heats the air inside the dough and then bakes the dough from the inside out. This whole process is just magical to me. I could just go on for hours about bread, but it's a lovely metaphor. Life is challenging. This last year has been ridiculously challenging. Loving my children and loving people is challenging. Sometimes people get very sick or die. Sometimes we get depressed or sad. But if we are growing together and growing with God, the slow work of rising and the intensity of the baking can yield a delicious result.
Thank you, Laura. Wow, two brilliant reflections so far. Russ and Christina Dick, for those of you who don't know, they are Canadians. Russ is from Winkler. Christina, I believe, is from Saskatchewan. They've been living down in Georgia for many years now in a community called Jubilee Partners, which works with refugees who have recently landed in the U.S. They're dear friends of Covenant, of many of us, and consider this to be a home congregation when they're back north for visits. And they've written something that Don's going to read now.
I should have put on suspenders for this. I'll be reading in Russ's voice, and then kind of halfway through, I turn into Christina. So hopefully that'll make sense as this goes. Good morning, everyone, and greetings in the name of our risen Lord. It's so good to think of all of you gathered at Duggan Pearls this morning. We will pray for your gathering, and we're so grateful for the ways that you've held us in prayer in these last months. We are thankful for a chance to share in your fellowship today. In late January of this year, we received a phone call that completely upset our lives and our plans, leading us into a journey we had not expected. But really, this journey began in October of 2008, when we joyfully welcomed nearly three-year-old Mulapa into our home. Mulapa's family arrived at Jubilee under great stress. Her mother had passed away in a Thai refugee camp only 4 months earlier, and her father suffered severe stomach illnesses. During their 2 months at Jubilee, Christina often cared for Mulapa and her three older brothers. When their family moved to Atlanta, her father repeatedly called back to Jubilee, saying no one would care for her daughter while he tried to get a job. At this time, Christina and I had been living in community and serving refugees at Jubilee Partners for about 3 years. Many newly arrived refugees had passed through our lives, spending 2 months with us before resettling in Atlanta. While grateful for getting to know so many different people, we longed for a deeper relationship with a particular family, one which our home would be a place of welcome. We were so grateful that we could host Mulapa in our home. In 2009, after she had been living with us for about a year, her father abruptly moved the whole family to Minnesota. Mulapa's absence left a big hole in our lives, and try as we might, it was a hole that could not be filled. We stayed in touch with the family and starting in 2012, Mulapa's father began to send her to Georgia with us for the summer school breaks. These were precious times in which an unbreakable bond fused the three of us together, making the end of summer trips to return her to Minneapolis heartbreaking. Over time, it became apparent that her father, Hutse, struggled with post-traumatic stress disorder, which often manifests itself in paranoia. Employment, parenting, anger management, and basic decision-making have become ongoing challenges for him. We could see that this was not a good environment for Mulapa. Even as we agonized over this and struggled with anger and judgmentalism, we were also so thankful for the growing relationship with Mulapa and repeatedly said to God, "You must bring us together again, and you did bring us together for a reason. What is your plan?" During this past year, the family continued to struggle with basic things, such as school attendance. And finally, in January, we learned that Moolapah had been removed from her father's home by Minnesota Child Protection. She's been in foster care ever since. I, Russ, have struggled with horrible anxiety over the past 5 months. In the past, I've often balked at authority, so having to engage the world of lawyers, judges, social workers, and courts has been ground that I never wanted to tread. As well, my daily routines are rather monotonous. Wake up, drink tea, milk the cow, tend to the other livestock chores, eat breakfast, go about my daily work. But now our daily routines have become anything but routine, with phone calls and emails to social workers and lawyers, airplane trips to Minnesota, and many restless nights. But early on, we were overwhelmed by the words of a wise elder. He wrote to us, "Have you considered that this current situation might be an answer to your prayers? You longed for this little girl to be in your home. It may very well be that God has chosen to use the courts to make a decision for you that her father never could make. Use the courts to bring healing and wholeness. Hire a lawyer to speak truth to power. Could God really bring glory to his name in a courtroom?" These were new and difficult thoughts for us, but what could we do but trust God's project, even if we constantly questioned the route he had chosen? A friend of ours who tragically lost his young son shared a passage of scripture from Psalm 119, verse 105. "Your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path." He reflected on this by saying, "God's guidance is just that, it's a lamp, and a lamp only gives so much light. It won't light up the entire path before us, but it does give us enough light for just the few steps ahead." Some other scripture verses that have helped us during this time are James 1, verse 5, and Philippians 4, verse 4 to 7. The James passage says this, "If any of you is lacking in wisdom, ask God, who gives to all generously and ungrudgingly, and it will be given to you." And Philippians, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to everyone. The Lord is near. Do not worry about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guide your hearts and your minds in Jesus Christ." And then Romans 12, verse 12, "Rejoice in hope. Be patient in suffering. Persevere in prayer." Prayer has been the single most powerful tool at our disposal these months. There are times when we can pray fervently, even if through tears, calling out with confidence our earnest petitions, and we feel God's peace surround us. But just as often, we've felt unable to pray. Often, there's a lack of words on our lips and a lack of trust in our hearts. In those times, we have leaned heavily on the prayers of others. Even at our lowest times, we've found rest in the knowledge that intercessions are brought on our and Moolapah's behalf, even when we are too weary to bring them ourselves. And then gradually strength to continue comes, and we can say again, "Thanks be to God for the body of Christ, giving us a voice when we have lost ours." Today, I, Christina, find myself in Minneapolis. This time, I'm blessed to have Moolapah with me for a few weeks at a friend's house. Moolapah is still technically in foster care, and the time frame for her eventually move to our home in Georgia is still very hazy, but it's only a matter of time until we have her in our home. Last night, as I put her to bed, she prayed in her own special way for this process to be sped up. We are thankful to see her finding rest in God's good plan for her life. As we anticipate getting custody of Moolah Paw in the next few weeks or months, our attention has shifted a little bit. Instead of simply dealing with the immediate, we are also pushed to think of the long-term implications of our relationship with Moolah Paw. We approach parenthood knowing that this is not the time to slack off in our prayer life. God is already revealing to us the many hard lessons we must learn about ourselves in this new family structure. We enter this next phase of the journey with fear and trembling, as well as with great joy and eager anticipation. We hope that in our sharing this morning you have heard this: Jesus' resurrection power is at work in this world, in our lives, and in yours. We have felt the temptation to give up or to force our own will, but we've heard God speak strongly against those voices. For whatever season of life you find yourself in today, may the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, guide your hearts and your minds in Jesus Christ.